From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour will be made on Wednesday, when a number of local candidates for office will gather for a candidate forum. The goal is to address a range of issues important to voters, and the forum's organizers are asking both voters and candidates to put children first. The Children's Agenda is working with a number of community partners to host that forum. They're asking the question, what would legislation look like if it prioritized children in need in our community? This hour, we explore that question and discuss a range of issues, including early intervention and preschool special education funding, childcare services, and how to better protect children from abuse and neglect. Our guests also want to hear from you. What do you want to see candidates prioritize this election season? Joining me in studio this hour are Bridget Hurley, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Heather Hansen is here. She's the COO at Step by Step Development Services and a physical therapist. Welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
Danielle Salamone is a member of Parents Helping Parents Coalition of Monroe County. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Bridget Shumway is here, the president of Generations Childcare. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you would like to join this conversation and share your priorities when it comes to putting children first, you can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org, and you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. And I know, Bridget Hurley, that you want to hear from people. You want to know what's on voters' minds, and that's part of the focus of the forum this coming Wednesday. Tell us a little bit about what we can expect and where people should go.
Okay. Well, the forum is Wednesday evening of this week, October 16th, from 7 to 9 p.m. It's going to be held at the new Y in Pittsburgh, the Shotland Family Y on the corner of Jefferson Road and Clover. And it is going to, the format is going to be a series of questions that will come from us as the co-sponsors, and then we'll open it up to the audience. And the purpose of it really is, as you said, just to give folks a chance to meet their potential county legislator or county executive and have a dialogue that we hope will be really interesting.
And much like the program this hour, that forum is a nonpartisan forum.
Absolutely, yes. All candidates for office have been invited regardless of party.
Mm-hmm. And you, we talked a little before the hour, you don't have to name names, but you have, how many people do you have in attendance right now?
We have 13 candidates.
Great.
Who have committed, and the audience is open to the public, so we don't have a count on that yet. But yes, and we have a mix of Democrats, Republicans, Libertarian, Independents, so it'll be a good mix.
Good. Are you hearing from voters in advance about the types of questions that they hope will be asked of the candidates?
Absolutely.
What's on their minds?
On their minds is the early intervention and preschool special education program. That's been a big topic at county legislature meetings for a few months now. Childcare, as always, because childcare is such a big issue for families all over the county. Of course, there's been the concern around Child Protective Services with the Tim Hortons incident. And so I know folks want to talk a little bit about that. And then we'll see. There, you know, vaccinations, safe sleep, juvenile justice, you know, we're just looking forward to hearing what's on folks' mind.
How long is the forum? It begins at 7, runs until?
7 to 9.
Good. Two solid hours to hear from candidates. That's
right.
Great.
And we will start promptly because we have a lot to talk about.
Excellent. Well, we have, as you mentioned, a lot to talk about this hour, but I'd like to start just by going around the table and asking each of our guests what's on their priority list. What's the number one issue for each of you, both for the forum and for this election season? And I'll start with you, Heather. What's number one?
So I think the number one issue is continuing to look at the providers that we have for early intervention and preschool special education. We continue to have providers leaving the system, which then impacts the children's needs. So what happens is children end up waiting for services, and we would like to change that.
Mm-hmm. Bridget Shumway.
I would say getting as many families to utilize subsidies as qualify for subsidies is probably our number one issue.
Where's the discrepancy right now?
Oh, I think it's in a lot of different places. You know, sometimes it's just families being aware of what they're eligible for, how long it might take to get approved for it, also just what their work schedule is. Sometimes they can qualify, sometimes they can't. And we need to support all those families that really do need quality care.
We'll talk about all of that this hour for sure. Danielle, what's on your priority list? What's number one?
I agree with Heather. I feel like preschool special education and early intervention funding should be primary on everyone's minds.
And you have some personal experience with that. Do children?
I do.
Both of them have benefited from EI services.
So I actually have three girls.
Oh, three.
And my oldest and youngest have both been through preschool, special ed, and early intervention. My youngest child is still in preschool special ed, but they both went through early intervention and both benefited greatly from it.
Great. And we'll hear more about that this hour as well. Bridget Hurley, what's number one on your list? I know you have a big list, but what's number one if you were to choose?
I do have a big list, and I think I'm going to not say what's number one, but say what's on my mind in addition to the folks around this table here so we can each speak to different issues. So, of course, we're concerned about child protective services and that the system work well and do what it's designed to do, which is keep children safe. And we are tracking the implementation of the county executive's 8-point reform plan that was introduced a couple of years ago. Our real concern, honestly, is prevention. We would like to keep kids out of the system entirely by implementing high-quality preventive programs that are proven to work. I think we need to make that distinction that we can spend a lot of money on a lot of services and still not quite get the biggest benefit because we're not using evidence-based models. And so that, I would say, across the board, prevention programs would be one of our biggest priorities.
Okay. Let's start with early intervention and preschool special education services. And I'd like to start there because I think there is a lot of confusion in the community, both among residents and the media, about what the difference between those two things are, and myself included. I've done a lot of reading and listening for this program today, and I have to say there's so many nuances. I want to start with Heather and just have you explain what is the difference between those two programs, early intervention services and preschool special education services.
Yep. So both of them are part of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is a federal law, and there are two parts to that law. So Part C is the early intervention piece. What that says is that children under the age of three, so birth until their third birthday, are eligible for therapeutic intervention services when there is a documented delay. Okay, so that program serves the babies who we know either are at risk or have already fallen behind in their skills across all the domains of development. That program is administered by the state. The state sets the rates for that program, and then the county health department does the intake and sort of administers it locally. Our county health department then contracts with agencies like mine to actually provide the therapy services. Preschool special education is Part B of that federal law. That part of the program is administered through the state education department and the local school districts, and overseen by the county as well. Those rates for the part of those rates for the related services, so the things like physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, those rates are set by the county. Same provider pool, so contracted agencies provide those services. Some of those children then need a classroom, so they might go to a special education classroom, and that's where it gets very confusing because the classroom rates are set by the state. And so there's lots of players in it, but the bottom line is each service serves different age children who have delays that they need some help getting them ready for school age. So preschool special education goes up until kids turn five and then go to kindergarten.
Is there a reason that these two programs are separate when it comes to funding and who controls which rates? Do you think it should be one big program, you know, zero to five? Why are they broken out like that right now?
So each state has their own sort of discretion in how to set up the program, and this is the way that New York State has set up their program in terms of whose domain each of the services fall under. Different states have different models. So there's basically 50 different models in our country of how these programs work to meet the federal requirement.
Would you like to see them combined, or do you feel like it's working the way it is right now, outside of the reimbursement rate issue, but should they be combined?
You know, I think there's a lot of benefit to one seamless system, and so there is some benefit to that. In terms of both the providers and the child, they get sort of the service is in a little bit more of a seamless way. And so I think there is some benefit to thinking about a system that would be a little bit more continuous for kids.
Okay. Bridget Hurley, I see you nodding.
Yes, absolutely. One of our recommendations to the state is to, someday there may be an actual merge, but certainly very soon we should figure out a way to coordinate the two systems so that parents don't have to learn a whole new system as soon as their child turns age 3.
Mm-hmm. Let's do a quick update of what's going on with that early intervention program, because we've talked about it at length on this show, and I understand that there is still the capacity list. I'm careful not to use the word waiting list. I was told that that's not okay. Let's explain why the word waiting list is not okay as we get very wonky this hour. But Bridget, why are we using the term capacity list rather than waiting list?
Well, it's actually illegal to have a wait list.
Okay.
And so, but it is also the reality that there is a wait list. In fact, I believe the wait list currently at EI is around 200 children. Actually, that was at the end of the school year, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's lower now. It's always lower in the beginning. And it's about 50 right now.
50 children on the capacity list waiting to be paired with a provider.
Right.
Okay.
And that's often more like single digit. Is that right, Heather, at the beginning of the school year, because there's openings from kids who have moved on to preschool special ed?
Correct. So historically, you go back 5 years, there really wasn't a capacity list at all. And then in the last several years, when you hit the fall, there is more openings for providers. And so there's not typically been a capacity list when we enter the fall season, because the children who've turned 5 go to kindergarten. And if they still need any support, that happens in their school district. And so then providers have more availability to then take the kids who have been waiting to be matched with a provider. So it is lower than it was at the end of the school year when everybody was still in the program, but it is still higher than it should be at this point.
How are we doing in terms of the number of providers that are available? That's something we've talked about on the show with you in the past. Mm-hmm. And the county executive, Cheryl Donolfo, is arguing that even after they reshuffled some responsibilities so there were more service coordinators, there's still a major lack of providers. So that's in part why we have the capacity list. How is that looking right now, the provider availability, and how do we create an opportunity to bring in more providers?
So their providers continue to leave the field. I think the data from this summer was that 24 providers across agencies left from our provider agencies to mostly school districts or other jobs in other industries. And my opinion running the company that I run is that it all comes down to salary and benefits, because the reimbursement rates are much lower than they should be. They are lower in absolute dollars than they were 15 years ago. And so providers can only sustain that for so long before they are going to look somewhere else where they can get a better paycheck and better benefits. So, you know, there's some hope out there, you know, to go to the other side of it. We, several agencies in the area have been able to hire some new staff, but we still have providers leaving on a consistent basis.
And the reimbursement rate for providers is set by the state.
For early intervention.
For early intervention.
Yes.
Okay. So when you speak with candidates at the forum on Wednesday, what is your main question for them or main push for them as you address this issue?
So in relation to early intervention, the big question is, what are you going to do to be Monroe County's voice at the state level? Myself as a voter and myself as a provider and all of the parents that we work with, we have a voice. But as an elected official who represents Monroe County, we need more voice at the state level to help improve the situation there.
Do you feel that, and this is a question for all of our panelists, again, not a partisan discussion, but as you look at it today, do you feel that the current county executive has done a good job pushing for more funding at the state level?
Monroe County has definitely advocated at the state level and has, I know, tried to influence the advocacy of the New York State Association of Counties so that all the county executives would get together and create some pressure on the early intervention issue. So there definitely has been some pressure from Monroe County to the state.
Danielle, how do you feel as a parent?
I feel like we could always be doing better. A lot of the parents that we have heard from in starting our Coalition of Monroe the Parents Helping Parents Coalition of Monroe County have all had stories of providers leaving. There have been stories of being on the capacity list and not able to have providers for their children, or getting, say, a speech provider, but having to wait even longer for a physical therapist.
If you had to ask one question at the candidate forum related to this issue, what would it be, Danielle? Coming at it from the parenting perspective, the firsthand experience, not just numbers, having navigated this system.
So we've done a lot of telling our stories to these people at the legislative meetings. So maybe not the candidates that will be there if they're not already on the legislation, but we have done a lot of sharing our stories and telling them heart to heart, you know, what it means to us as families and what it means to our children. But I agree. I think the question needs to be, what can you do for us to help us advocate at the state level to increase funding so that we can obtain more providers, so that less people are on the waiting list, the capacity list? I think there are families out there right now that don't know what they don't know. So they are on this list and they just are in the thick of it. They don't understand what they're missing out on. So we need to work as hard as we can to advocate at the state level to make things better.
How long did you wait before your daughters were matched with a provider?
I never had to wait.
Oh, excellent.
So both of my children, let's say 2 years ago was my youngest, and then it was almost 5 years ago for my oldest. So there wasn't a capacity list back then.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Go ahead, Bridget.
I just want to make clear, again, this difference between early intervention and preschool special education, mm-hmm. because the county has a much more direct impact on preschool special education in those related services like PT and OT. The county executive, D'Onofrio, last year increased the rates by 15%, which is great. We needed to be probably another 20 or 30%, and so I would certainly say that in terms of preschool special education, that there needs to be another increase in rates. Additionally, there is this issue of service coordination, which was what kind of came to the fore in the middle of the county budget situation at the end of 2018. There was a remedy that was put in place. What I hear from providers and parents is that it's not enough, and that we still need more service coordinators. Those are really critical people who can guide the family. You know, as Danielle said, so many families, you know, get news about their child's developmental delay or disability, and, you know, their life kind of explodes, and they really need someone who can say, here's where you can get help, and here's how to do it, and, you know, to go have providers come into the home, and so they're not having to drive. Those service coordinators definitely need some more attention.
Mm-hmm. And some background on that, too. Just like therapy providers, several agencies who were providing service coordination on the outside have closed their doors. And so much more of the responsibility for the children who are currently in early intervention now falls with those service coordinators who work for the county. So they have much higher caseloads at this point, and they're completely overworked and not necessarily able to do the full job that Bridget was talking about in terms of providing the support to families from that level.
Bridget, when you mentioned the rate increase of 15%, let's make sure that our listeners understand what that means, because that increase, the county executive said it was an across-the-board increase for preschool special education services. I know, you're smiling. We've got to get in the weeds.
How much time do we have?
I think we can distill it down. I have some audio we can listen to help us, but the 15% increase was for the individual rates, not group rates. So let's take one short moment and talk about the difference between individual rates and group rates.
Right. So the rate, obviously, for group is lower because their provider's sitting with two or three children. And but in Monroe County, I'm looking to Heather, too, to make sure, because in Monroe County, my understanding was that the tradition was that if you had a child whose plan recommended a group session, but there was no other child available to be in that session, that the provider would get the individual rate. And at the same time that the county increased the reimbursement rate. They changed a little bit how they handled that payment for group versus individual rates. So I am just going to like get very broad and say there was a lot of back and forth mm-hmm. conversations, and I think we got to a point where everybody was satisfied, at least for the time being, that those providers who were doing group rates, particularly for a situation where there was not more than one child available, were getting a fair shake. Would you say, Heather?
Yes. So, yes. Okay. So the way it currently stands, if you see one child, even if it's written as a group session, you get the same payment as you would as if it were an individual session. The 15% increase, before this happened in July, there was not a different rate for a group session versus an individual session in Monroe County. And so the rate that we got paid before July is currently the same as the rate that we get paid now for a group session of two or more children.
Okay. So prior to the change, the individual rate was $52. Mm-hmm. With the increase, it's now $60 for those individual sessions. If it's a group session, the rate is still $52 times each child. So
correct.
$52 per child.
Correct.
So there's, okay. Mm-hmm. I think we've established a foundation. Thank you for hanging in there with me. When County Executive Cheryl DeNolfo was on this program in June, Evan asked her why there was confusion among providers over the issue. And Heather and Bridget, I know you have a lot mm-hmm. to say on it, but I'd like to listen to what the county executive said about that. Here's what she told us in June.
It's interesting because they are part of the council, and I honestly think it was maybe a misunderstanding, because when I announced the 15% across the board at the legislature meeting, we handed out all of the rates. Everything was there, and it was months later.
To the media and to the legislators, right?
To the media and the legislatures, and certainly our preschool operators who had been at the legislature, they come to the legislature every single meeting, which is great. It's always good to hear the concerns of citizens, and I'm always happy to speak with them. In fact, there were many times that I would just go out into the audience and speak with our providers, see how they were doing, and how we could continue to work together. But certainly the providers, through our partnership, our PIP Council, they were well aware of what those rates were going to be in the establishment of the rates. So we have been consistent in saying that there's going to be a group rate for the first time. We thought we had consensus on that.
Heather, help us square this up. Do you feel like the county executive is being fair there?
So I will reiterate what was asked in the question that you played. So the packet was handed out to the legislatures and to the media. It was not handed out to any of the provider agencies. So that was announced in March. We did not have any communication about what the actual rate structure was going to look like until the middle of May. So we had a two-month gap where we were not able to provide input on that. Now, I could have contacted the media. I could have contacted somebody else. That is true. But it should not be my responsibility as a provider to not have the communication for something that impacts me. And running the company and my provider agency, my provider's rates. So yes, it was handed out to certain people, but it wasn't handed out to the people who it impacted directly and to who could have the most input in terms of how that would play out and how we do our rates. And so it wasn't until that point that we literally, the day that we all saw the rates, our voices were raised because we knew the implications that it was going to have. And so if that had happened earlier, then we could have had more conversations at an earlier point to say, you know what, this doesn't make sense based on how things have been done. But there definitely was a gap in time between when we were informed of the rates.
Mm-hmm. Bridget, your colleague Pete Nabosny said in our program in May that Monroe County misrepresented their announcement about reimbursement rates for services and that they should have never said it was across the board. Do you feel like the county since then has done a more transparent job of communicating?
I would say at the end point when the final resolution was coming into place that, yes, they were more transparent at that point.
What would you like to have seen? What would you like to have been different from the beginning? How would you like to have been involved, or maybe not? But I would assume you're going to say you wanted to be involved. What would that look like? What's an ideal situation for you?
Right. So, you know, we're we do this work day in and day out. And so I think having conversations directly with the providers before proposals are made at a legislative level is really important. And we do have monthly meetings with the county health department, but those are really not the forum to discuss the legislative pieces of it. And then the way things are set up, the rates are set legislatively. And so what I would like to see is more voices at the table in part of the conversations about when proposals are made, when ideas come out about how we can improve the system. All of the stakeholders need to be at the table.
Challenger Adam Bello had some things to say about this issue and how he would have handled it if he were county executive right now. So let's listen to what he said when he joined us on Connections in June.
If I were the county executive, I would have brought the advocates together, the providers together, and we would have created a strategy on, A, how are we going to lobby the state and identify this as a community priority for Monroe County? What are we going to do to lobby the New York State delegation, the governor, and New York State to increase those reimbursement rates and do it together? I would have done that before it became a crisis at a county legislature budget meeting and before those advocacy efforts spilled out in that way. I would have done it collaboratively. The second thing I would have done differently is before I announced the increase in rates, this across-the-board increase that turned out not to be across the board, I again would have brought the advocates and the providers themselves into the room and sit around the table and have a conversation about what the new rate structure we were considering was and find out what the unintended consequence of that would be. Because the goal at the end of the day is to increase the number of providers who can provide those services to children. We have hundreds of children right now, according to the Children's Agenda, on a waiting list right now, waiting for those services at a critical peer point in their development. And so the real goal of what county government should be doing is figuring out a way to bring in more providers so there's no waiting list. I would have put them around the table so that when the contracts were released and they were expecting a 15% increase across the board, they wouldn't have been surprised by what they saw. They'd be part of the process. That's what I think is missing about the way the government's being run right now.
So that was Challenger Adam Bello responding to some of the issues that we've been discussing related to preschool special education services, those reimbursement rates. Heather, I'll turn back to you. That sounds very similar to what you had proposed before. If that were to happen, how often do you think that providers should be meeting with the county on these issues?
Well, I think our monthly meetings right now are a good forum for that, but it needs to include some of the other pieces, and it needs to include the people who are voting on the issues as well. And then at times when there are big topics going on or big issues going on, then it may need to be more frequently or in a different venue, because that provider meeting really is not designed to look at when there's sort of the crisis issues, right? So then there may need to be a different venue for that to happen.
Okay, Bridget.
Yeah, I just want to step back a little bit and take a look at all the issues that we are talking about here today. Transparency makes everything easier. If we put the best minds together and the best ideas around how can we improve kids' lives in Monroe County, everything will go smoother and will be better for families and for the kids. So, for example, Bridget Chumley, I know you were going to talk about in the past there's been a child care monthly, quarterly meeting, yeah, where the county would meet with providers. And that's something that we're looking for continually, because that was stopped. And I think, you know, you might remember a few years back there was quite a bit of conversation about child care subsidies. And it just would make everything move smoother if we could be continually having this conversation.
I know discussing all the intricacies of this is important, but I also don't want to forget that we're talking about families mm-hmm. that are confused, that need help, that are concerned. And Danielle, when we talk about these wonky policy issues, which again are important, what do you hope that candidates understand about the human side, and how would life have been different for you if your daughters had not been able to access these services?
So I think the most important thing for people to realize is that when services are provided earlier, you end up with a completely different child. The services, when these services that are being provided are, let's say, X amount of money, by the time they get into kindergarten and regular education, they're paying five times as much to give the kids these same services that, if they had been provided with earlier, would have made such a big difference. My children are walking and talking and doing all of these things that if they had not had early intervention, someone coming into my house and playing appropriately with them to teach them colors. And the way that these providers are spending time with my kid every minute is being utilized to teach them a new skill and to make them better people sounds awful, but they are becoming who they were meant to be because they have these providers there working with them constantly.
Mm-hmm. We're late for our only break of the hour, and we have so much more to discuss with our guests. So when we come back from our break, we'll talk about child care subsidies. We'll talk about child protective services. Listeners, we'll take some of your questions that are starting to come in. So hang in there. Much more connections after the short break. I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on The Next Connections, what does it mean to be an ethical business in 2019? We asked that question with winners of the 2019 Effie Awards, the Ethical Business Awards. We'll hear what they're doing in their companies to create ethical business models and what they hope people across the community will understand about ethics in business. Then in our second hour, a conversation about stillbirth and how it affects families. This is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson. Today, we're talking about what legislation would look like if it put children first. And that comes in advance of an upcoming forum, candidate forum, hosted by the Children's Agenda, among other partners in the community. Our guests include Bridget Hurley, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda, Heather Hansen, COO at Step by Step Developmental Services. She's also a physical therapist. Danielle Salamone is here. She's a member of Parents Helping Parents Coalition of Monroe County. And Bridget Shumway, President of Generations Child Care. Let's revisit that forum one more time, Bridget, or at least one more time, so Absolutely. Our listeners know where to go and when, and it's free and open to the public, correct?
Yes, everyone is invited to come and attend, and we have invited every candidate for county legislature or county executive that's currently running for election. It is Wednesday evening at the new
Shotland Family
Shotland, Line. Sorry, yeah. I said it wrong at the lunch meeting the other day, so I was checking to make sure. New Shotland Family YMCA in Pittsford, 7 to 9 on Wednesday.
Great. And a number of candidates from many different parties signed up to participate in that. Just an update for our listeners about our election coverage here at WXXI. Adam Bello, who is running for county executive, will be on this program on Wednesday, the 23rd. We have invited County Executive Cheryl DiNolfo to join him or to have her own hour on the program. We have not heard back from her campaign after multiple attempts. We're still going to try. We want to give our listeners an opportunity to hear from as many candidates as possible before November 5th. So you can hear Adam Bello on October 23rd, and we hope also County Executive Cheryl DiNolfo. So let's address another issue that has reached one of the top spots on the priority list, Bridget Shumway, when it comes to how to put children first, and that comes to child care subsidies. Tell us about the current situation in Monroe County. What are we looking at right now?
Well, currently we're looking at about 7,500 children who receive subsidies, and that's down from about 10 years ago when it was over 13,000 children.
Okay. And you said there are some gaps, some disparities, and possibly some parents not knowing that they qualify. What are some of those gaps?
Well, one of the things that I found interesting and something the county recently I read about said that every month they have a meeting to look at how they're doing with the funding they have. Are they overspent or are they underspent? And I think one thing that they could do is use technology to get that information out there. I think it would be so simple to have a list of all the providers and just say, you know, we have openings right now. Because we have families that struggle, particularly the families who are not receiving a subsidy. It's very expensive to be in quality childcare today. And often we would like to let those families know that they might be eligible if there's funding available.
What is the average cost of child care, if you're able to put a number on that?
Yeah, so for infants right now, it's $310 a week at Generations. I think for a four-year-old, it's probably $285. Mm-hmm.
So who are some of the families that you think could benefit from hearing, hey, you qualify, here's what you can receive? If you were, I don't want to talk about people in categories, but are we talking about families with multiple children, families at a certain income level? Just help us understand who is qualified that's not benefiting right now.
Well, anyone that's probably under 275% of the poverty line would benefit from child care. I think for a family of three right now, if your income is around $52,000, you would qualify. But if you think about the fact that infant care is $15,000, you know, if you're making even $75,000, it's really tough to make those numbers.
What are some of the conversations you're hearing from parents who are at Generations Child Care? Are they struggling? Do they have questions about additional subsidies? What are some of their concerns?
Well, first of all, I do think it's important to give credit where credit's due. And this year, the county executive did lower the parent fee from 35% to 25%. And that was very beneficial for a number of families. Families who are at the very low income level, that probably didn't make a lot of difference. But for some other families, it was significant. I think that there's some rules that make it stressful for families who actually do qualify for subsidies. One in particular is the rule that their child must be in care 30 hours a week. Now, that might not sound so difficult, but if your child is sick, you're going to miss those hours. And so providers are left with two choices. One, to have less reimbursement, which makes it even more difficult for our workforce, or two, to charge the family. And if the family's already on a subsidy, they probably can't afford to make up that additional cost. So one of the things that we'd like to see the county do is to allow for some absences for children whose families receive subsidies. Private pay families pay the same whether their child's there or not. And we think that this would be good for both children and for families. It's really unfair to have a family bring their child to child care when they're ill because they're in that situation. And this is something that the county does control through their child and family services plan.
How many absences must there be before a family is told, I'm sorry, you no longer qualify for this service? Is there a number
That's really up to the provider. So, mm-hmm. You know, if the provider is willing to allow the absences and not
absorb
charge the family, you know, that's an individual provider choice. Years ago, the county did provide absences. I think it was maybe no more than 24 in a six-month period. Now, the only absences that are allowed are if your child is enrolled under a protective or preventive case, and that's three a month.
Okay. Bridget Hurley, regarding this issue, what does the Children's Agenda hope to see?
Well, we hope to see more families having access to high-quality care, and I just want to take a minute to make sure we're all hearing what we're saying here, which is high-quality care. It makes a big difference in a child's life, whether they're going to a setting where there's lots of opportunities for play and there's healthy food and lots of developmentally appropriate toys and practices, and as opposed to a home where perhaps they're, you know, sitting in front of the TV or constrained in terms of not being able to go outside. So we're looking for high-quality care. Subsidies allow low-income families to purchase high-quality care because they can't afford to private pay for a high-quality care setting. So we certainly want more children to have access to that. In years past, we have had situations where the county has run out of money and said, I'm sorry, we can't provide any more subsidies. That's not where we're now right now, which is really terrific. We're thrilled with that. There still are some difficulties with families accessing care because of the application process can be very complicated. It's easy to leave out a form and then have to wait to then submit another form. So the application process could definitely be streamlined. There's situations with sanctions. So a family can be sanctioned and not allowed to use their subsidy any longer. There is a hearing process, but that's very cumbersome as well. We share, the child care field shares with early intervention and preschool special ed a difficulty around workforce.
Some centers and family homes literally have trouble just hiring enough people to meet the ratios that are established by federal regulation. And if you do not have that one staff person for the four infants that you have, you cannot provide care to those infants. And so these are all ways that create things that create barriers to families who really need high quality care. And as we do as well, because we know, you know, as Danielle said, if we're investing in really good start in life, then those kids are going to grow up to be healthier, happier, more productive members of society.
What is the biggest barrier among those barriers that you mentioned? I know that's a simplistic question, but as I'm trying to understand this issue as you all discuss it. What is the number one hurdle that is making everything else more difficult?
Yeah, I don't know that I would name just one at this point, given that there are there is funding for subsidies. I think it's a combination of the provider shortage, the difficulty in getting workforce, and still the cost. You know, it still is a challenge, and the getting that to work with your work schedule, as Bridget said, is an issue. So obviously, there's not just one. I will say there is a looming threat, just to let folks know this is not anything that the county can take care of, but there's new federal regulations being implemented that are going to make it even harder for child care settings to hire staff. And that's going to leave some children without care in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Bridget, did you want to
add? I was just going to say the other barrier is transportation, you know, in terms of accessing high quality care.
If I'm a parent who qualifies for a subsidy, I've found out through the excellent work that all of you are doing, I qualify and I'm excited to sign up. How do I do that? Where do I go? Who do I talk to? In case we have people listening who think, I wonder if I qualify, and if I do, how do I start the process?
Well, you would call the county. You can go on their website, and if I could get my phone to work quick enough, I could give you the phone number. But there is a page on the county's website for applying for child care. It's quite a process. I have a folder with the application, and it's many pages and many little boxes, so it's not easy, but that's where they would start.
Okay. Is there assistance available for people who may need some help with that?
Well, I know Bridget's...
Certain providers will help the families fill out the applications. I'm sure that there's assistance through the Child Care Council for families also to receive help with that.
Okay. All right. Great. I know we also want to talk about child protective services. We're coming down to the end of the hour, so I want to make sure we have enough time to address that. And Bridget Hurley, you mentioned the 8-point plan that County Executive Donolfo has put in place. Let's talk a little bit about the issue with CPS as it stands right now. Mm-hmm. What are we currently looking at?
Well, I feel like a broken record. It's staffing and workforce again. A couple of years ago, the county, the reason why there is an 8-point plan is because there was a tremendous gap in the number of caseworkers that were available versus what's needed to come even close to what the state suggests in terms of a caseload ratio. One big issue is that we don't know what's happening. We do know that several of the points of the reform plan were implemented and had been in place. There are others where we're not able to get the information to monitor how the implementation is going. It's not an easy process. We're talking about recruitment, and then people have to go through training, and so we're not saying it should have been done right away. But we don't know exactly what the situation is.
Why is it that the information isn't available? Is that a county issue, that the county is not?
The county has the information.
And they are not sharing the information after it's been requested?
Right.
Okay. Okay. So let's talk about the rate of child deaths. I don't mean to blow by that comment I just made. I think that's something that will require some questions and investigative work.
Absolutely.
Which we are committed to at WXXI. So I don't mean to just skirt by it, but we don't have the answers right now, and we can certainly look into.
Right. And I guess I just want to add to that. It's not that we want those numbers because we want to be the watchdog. You know, it's just that it makes planning easier and more effective if we're all sharing our information and our expertise. And I think there's many community members in Monroe County who would be happy to work with the county government, with any level of government, to come up with some really good solutions to the issues that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. So let's look at the most recent child fatality report. During 2017, The number of child deaths, children who were in the county's custody or care, that number rose to 27, up from 14 the year prior. According to the Democrat and Chronicle, this is the second highest number of fatality investigations for that year in any New York county except for Kings County in New York City, and accounts for roughly one out of every 10 child fatality investigations done by the OCFS in 2017. Is that a concern, Bridget?
It's definitely a concern. Of course, child fatalities are always a concern, and we know, given that there's an increase, it's certainly something that we need to take a look at. It is a bit like EI and preschool special ed, though, where I would just warn us that we need to, you know, dig deeper. It's not, first of all, any death, of course, is too many. Those are fairly small numbers, so the percentage increase and decrease over time can vary quite a bit just because you have a small number. Secondly, the cause of death is really important to ascertain, and I don't have the cause of death in all of those here right in front of me.
I have the breakdown if you want to walk through them. So the breakdown of the 27 fatalities from 2017, 14 were related to unsafe sleep practices, 2 were homicides, 3 were medical in nature, 7 were accidental, and 1 was related to domestic violence.
Okay, so that's exactly what I was going to say, is that there's different policy responses to different kinds of child fatalities. And so we certainly, you know, so we need to be looking at safe sleep and supporting young or early new parents in preventing that. And, you know, in terms of homicides, obviously that's a whole different response that it needs. So it definitely does need to be addressed. I think it's just going to have to be sort of multifaceted and based on what we're seeing. I will say, if I can, that there was a large commission and a report coming out of it a couple of years ago that looked at child fatalities across the United States. And the only program that commission recommended as an absolute proven way to deter child fatalities was the Nurse Family Partnership, which we have here in Monroe County. Mm-hmm. So good on us and the county that they have that program. It should be reaching every eligible parent because it makes a tremendous difference in a child's life.
I wanted to ask you a question about the former child abuse hotline. So OCFS has, again, according to the Democrat and Chronicle, has refused County Executive Cheryl DeNolfo's request to allow the county to reinstate a child abuse hotline. It was discontinued in 2015. And the office cited concerns that the previous in-house hotline may have potentially compromised the safety of children. And I'll open this up to all of our guests if you want to weigh in. How did you feel about the child abuse hotline?
We were never able to obtain anything that would lead us to believe that across the board kids were safer with the local hotline versus the state hotline. So we actually remained sort of agnostic on that because we couldn't. There's many opinions, very strong opinions, and I appreciate that. But we couldn't say that one would be much more safe for children.
Mm-hmm. Without being able to delve into the data of the 8-point plan because it's not available, if you could create your own plan, Bridget, what would that entail to improve the issues at CPS?
So I would come up with a 1-point plan.
I would love to hear a 1-point plan.
I mean, that I could come up with more, but we are really looking for that caseload ratio to get down to 12-1, because that means that there are enough adults working with families to provide support, to make a plan for coming out of the investigation to, you know, many, many times, over 90% of these cases of neglect are related to lack of resources. So it really makes a big difference when you have a caseworker who has a manageable caseload size.
Again, the upcoming forum, which is this Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Shotland Family YMCA in Pittsburgh, is a nonpartisan forum. This discussion has been a nonpartisan discussion. And as we close out the hour, I'd just like to ask each of our guests, do you feel like some of the issues that we've been addressing have become partisan in any way? Are you frustrated by conversations that have happened among different elected officials, different leaders in our community? Do you feel like they've become political?
I'm not frustrated by it. I'm not sure that I think they're political. I am frustrated that key players, and I would say that includes individuals from the county, the city, and the school district. We need them all to come together to advocate together and be one voice for children in this community. That is frustrating to us, I think.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I think coming together is the key point. And certainly in the time that we have been being vocal and going to LEDGE meetings, we have had points of frustration where it's very clearly things are happening along partisan lines. Certain one party is easier to speak with than another. Only, you know, some people will sign a memo to the state and other people won't. And that's frustrating. And so, again, I think the bottom line here is working together, and these should not be partisan issues. The well-being of children, the safety of children, and the developmental status of children should be something that everybody should be able to come together on.
Mm-hmm. Bridget?
Well, these decisions are being made to some extent by elected officials, and so that just makes it almost inevitable that some of them will become political and be used in a campaign. But, you know, of course, I agree, there's nothing more nonpartisan than children's well-being, right? And I honestly believe most individuals, regardless of party, do want things to be better for children in this community. Right, it's frustrating when it gets off into a point where it's partisan.
Mm-hmm. Danielle.
So I don't feel like I'm involved in politics enough to know if it has been made a political issue. I know talking to families, we're doing a lot of advocacy work at the legislative meetings. So I would not say, I guess I just don't know.
Okay, no, that's okay. That's a perfectly acceptable answer. And I want to thank all of you for being here. They all hope to see you, listeners, at their upcoming forum on Wednesday at 7 o'clock at the YMCA in Pittsburgh, the Shotland Family Y. Thanks to Bridget Hurley, Heather Hansen, Danielle Salamone, and Bridget Shumway for being here. Good luck to you at your forum. I hope you get some good questions. I know you will. You don't need luck. Also, thanks to Emma Ray Stein, our intern, Tim Shea, our volunteer for today. Rob Braden is the engineer. Thanks to Barsook Records and Ra Ra Riot for our theme music, which we love very much. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson. He'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.